Nothing. Not even a sound they can recognize. You mean you want to hear? You want to know what I do and why I do it? You want to know what I think? It's not boring to you? It's important?
Go ahead, said Rourke. Then he sat for hours, listening, while Mallory spoke of his work, of the thoughts behind his work, of the thoughts that shaped his life, spoke gluttonously, like a drowning man flung out to shore getting drunk on huge, clean snatches of air. Mallory came to Rourke's office on the following morning, and Rourke showed him the sketches of the temple. When he stood at a drafting table with a problem to consider, Mallory changed. There was no uncertainty in him, no remembrance of pain. The gesture of his hand taking the drawing was sharp and sure, like that of a soldier on duty. The gesture said that nothing ever done to him could alter the function of the thing within him that was now called into action. He had an unyielding, impersonal confidence. He faced Rourke as an equal. He studied the drawings for a long time, then raised his head. Everything about his face was controlled, except his eyes. "Like it?" Rourke asked. "Don't use stupid words." He held one of the drawings, walked to the window, stood looking from the sketch to the street, to Rourke's face, and back again. "It doesn't seem possible," he said. "Not this and that." He waved the sketch at the street. There was a pool room on the corner of the street below, a rooming house with a Corinthian portico, a billboard advertising a Broadway musical, a line of pink-gray underwear fluttering on a roof. "Not in the same city. Not on the same earth," said Mallory. "But you made it happen. It's possible. I'll never be afraid again."
"Of what?"
Mallory put the sketch down on the table cautiously. He answered,
"You said something yesterday about a first law, a law demanding that man seek the best. It was funny. The unrecognized genius, that's an old story. Have you ever thought of a much worse one? The genius recognized too well? That a great many men are poor fools who can't see the best. That's nothing. One can't get angry at that. But do you understand about the men who see it and don't want it?"
"No."
"No, you wouldn't. I spent all night thinking about you. I didn't sleep at all. Do you know what your secret is? It's your terrible innocence."
Rourke laughed aloud, looking at the boyish face.
"No," said Mallory, "it's not funny. I know what I'm talking about, and you don't. You can't know. It's because of that absolute health of yours. You're so healthy that you can't conceive of disease. You know of it, but you don't really believe it."
"I do.
I'm wiser than you are about some things, because I'm weaker. I understand the other side. That's what it did to me. What you saw yesterday.
That's over."
"Probably, but not quite. I'm not afraid anymore. But I know that the terror exists. I know the kind of terror it is. You can't conceive of that kind. Listen, what's the most horrible experience you can imagine? To me, it's being left unarmed in a sealed cell with a drooling beast of prey or a maniac who's had some disease that's eaten his brain out. You'd have nothing but your voice and your thought. You'd scream to that creature why it should not touch you. You'd have the most eloquent words, the unanswerable words. You'd become the vessel of the absolute truth, and you'd see living eyes watching you, and you'd know that the thing can't hear you, that it can't be reached, not in any way, yet it's breathing and moving there before you with a purpose of its own. That's horror. Well, that's what's hanging over the world, prowling somewhere through mankind, that same thing, something closed, mindless, utterly wanton, but something with an aim and a cunning of its own. I don't think I'm a coward, but I'm afraid of it. And that's all I know, only that it exists. I don't know its purposes. I don't know its nature."
"The principle behind the dean," said Rourke.
"What?"
"It's something I wonder about once in a while."
"Mallory, why did you try to shoot Ellsworth Toohey?"
He saw the boy's eyes, and he added,
"You don't have to tell me if you don't like to talk about it."
"I don't like to talk about it," said Mallory, his voice tight. "But it was the right question to ask."
"Sit down," said Rourke. We'll talk about your commission.
Then Mallory listened attentively while Rourke spoke of the building and of what he wanted from the sculptor. He concluded,
Just one figure. It will stand here.
He pointed to a sketch.
The place is built around it. The statue of a naked woman. If you understand the building, you understand what the figure must be. The human spirit, the heroic in man. The aspiration and the fulfillment, both. Uplifted in its quest, and uplifting by its own essence. Seeking God, and finding itself. Showing that there is no higher reach beyond its own form. You're the only one who can do it for me.
Yes.
You'll work as I work for my clients. You know what I want. The rest is up to you. Do it any way you wish. I'd like to suggest the model, but if she doesn't fit your purpose, choose anyone you prefer.
Who's your choice?
Dominique Francone.
Oh, God!
Know her?
I've seen her. If I could have her. Christ! There's no other woman so right for this. She...
He stopped. He added, deflated.
She won't pose. Certainly not for you.
She will.
Guy Francone tried to object when he heard of it. Listen, Dominique, he said angrily. There is a limit. There really is a limit, even for you. Why are you doing it? Why, for a building of Rourke's, of all things, after everything you've said and done against him. Do you wonder people are talking? Nobody'd care or notice if it were anyone else but you and Rourke. I can't go anywhere without having somebody ask me about it. What am I to do?
Order yourself a reproduction of the statue, Father. It's going to be beautiful.
Peter Keating refused to discuss it. But he met Dominique at a party, and he asked, having intended not to ask it, Is it true that you're posing for a statue for Rourke's temple?
Yes.
Dominique, I don't like it.
No?
Oh, I'm sorry. I know I have no right. It's only that, of all people, I don't want to see you being friendly with Rourke. Not Rourke. Anybody but Rourke.
She looked interested.
Why?
I don't know.
Her glance of curious study worried him.
Maybe, he muttered. Maybe it's because it has never seemed right that you should have such contempt for his work. It made me very happy that you had, but it never seemed right for you.
It didn't, Peter.
No. But you don't like him as a person, do you?
No, I don't like him as a person.
Ellsworth Toohey was displeased. It was most unwise of you, Dominique, he said in the privacy of her office. His voice did not sound smooth.
I know it was.
Can't you change your mind and refuse?
I won't change my mind, Ellsworth.
He sat down and shrugged.
After a while, he smiled.
All right, my dear, have it your own way.
She ran a pencil through a line of copy and said nothing.
Toohey lighted a cigarette. So he's chosen Stephen Mallory for the job, he said.
Yes, a funny coincidence, wasn't it?
It's no coincidence at all, my dear. Things like that are never a coincidence. There's a basic law behind it. Though I'm sure he doesn't know it, and nobody helped him choose.
I believe you approve.
Wholeheartedly. It makes everything just right. Better than ever.
Ellsworth, why did Mallory try to kill you?
I haven't the faintest idea. I don't know. I think Mr. Rourke does, or should. Incidentally, who selected you to pose for that statue? Rourke or Mallory?
That's none of your business, Ellsworth.
I see. Rourke.
Incidentally, I've told Rourke that it was you who made Hopton Stoddard hire him.
He stopped his cigarette in midair, then moved again and placed it in his mouth. You did? Why?
I saw the drawings of the temple.
That good?
Better, Ellsworth.
What did he say when you told him?
Nothing. He laughed.
He did. Nice of him. I dare say many people will join him after a while.
Through the months of that winter, Rourke seldom slept more than 3 hours a night. There was a swinging sharpness in his movements, as if his body fed energy to all those around him. The energy ran through the walls of his office to three points of the city, to the Cord Building in the center of Manhattan, a tower of copper and glass, to the Aquitania Hotel on Central Park South, and to the temple on a rock over the Hudson, far north on Riverside Drive. When they had time to meet, Austin Heller watched him, amused and pleased. "When these three are finished, Howard," he said, "nobody will be able to stop you, not ever again. I speculate occasionally upon how far you'll go. You see, I've always had a weakness for astronomy." On an evening in March, Rourke stood within the tall enclosure that had been erected around the site of the temple, according to Stoddard's orders. The first blocks of stone, the base of future walls, rose above the ground. It was late and the workers had left. The place lay deserted, cut off from the world, dissolved in darkness. But the sky glowed, too luminous for the night below, as if the light had remained past the normal hour in announcement of the coming spring. A ship's siren cried out once, somewhere on the river, and the sound seemed to come from a distant countryside, through miles of silence. A light still burned in the wooden shack built as a studio for Stephen Mallory, where Dominique posed for him. The temple was to be a small building of gray limestone. Its lines were horizontal, not the lines reaching to heaven, but the lines of the earth. It seemed to spread over the ground like arms outstretched at shoulder height, palms down, in great silent acceptance. It did not cling to the soil, and it did not crouch under the sky. It seemed to lift the earth, and its few vertical shafts pulled the sky down. It was scaled to human height in such a manner that it did not dwarf man, but stood as a setting that made his figure the only absolute, the gauge of perfection by which all dimensions were to be judged. When a man entered this temple, he would feel space molded around him, for him, as if it had waited for his entrance to be completed. It was a joyous place, with the joy of exaltation that must be quiet. It was a place where one would come to feel sinless and strong, to find the peace of spirit never granted save by one's own glory. There was no ornamentation inside, except the grated projections of the walls and the vast windows. The place was not sealed under vaults, but thrown open to the earth around it, to the trees, the river, the sun, and to the skyline of the city in the distance, the skyscrapers, the shapes of man's achievement on earth. At the end of the room facing the entrance, with the city as background, stood the figure of a naked human body. There was nothing before him now in the darkness except the first stones, but Rourke thought of the finished building, feeling it in the joints of his fingers, still remembering the movements of his pencil that had drawn it. He stood thinking of it. Then he walked across the rough, torn earth to the studio shack.
"Just a moment," said Mallory's voice when he knocked.
Inside the shack, Dominique stepped down from the stand and pulled a robe on. Then Mallory opened the door.
"Oh, it's you?" he said. "We thought it was the watchman. What are you doing here so late?"
"Good evening, Miss Francon," said Rourke, and she nodded curtly.
"Sorry to interrupt, Steve. It's all right, we haven't been doing so well. Dominique can't get quite what I want tonight. Sit down, Howard. What the hell time is it?"
9:30. "If you're going to stay longer, want me to have some dinner sent up?"
"I don't know. Let's have a cigarette."
The place had an unpainted wooden floor, bare wooden rafters, a cast-iron stove glowing in a corner. Mallory moved about like a feudal host, with smudges of clay on his forehead. He smoked nervously, pacing up and down.
"Want to get dressed, Dominique?" he asked. "I don't think we'll do much more tonight."
She didn't answer. She stood looking at Rourke. Mallory reached the end of the room, whirled around, smiled at Rourke.
"Why haven't you ever come in before, Howard? Of course, if I'd been really busy, I'd have thrown you out. What, by the way, are you doing here at this hour?"
"I just wanted to see the place tonight. Couldn't get here earlier."
"Is this what you want, Steve?" Dominique asked suddenly.
She took a robe off and walked naked to the stand. Mallory looked from her to Rourke and back again. Then he saw what he had been struggling to see all day. He saw her body standing before him, straight and tense, her head thrown back, her arms at her sides, palms out, as she had stood for many days, but now her body was alive, so still that it seemed to tremble, saying what he had wanted to hear, a proud, reverent, enraptured surrender to a vision of her own. The right moment. The moment before the figure would sway and break. The moment touched by the reflection of what she saw.
Mallory's cigarette went flying across the room. "Hold it, Dominique," he cried. "Hold it! Hold it!"
He was at his stand before the cigarette hit the ground. He worked, and Dominique stood without moving, and Rourke stood facing her, leaning against the wall. In April, the walls of the temple rose in broken lines over the ground. On moonlit nights they had a soft, smeared, underwater glow. The tall fence stood on guard around them. After the day's work, four people would often remain at the site. Rourke, Mallory, Dominique, and Mike Donegan. Mike had not missed employment on a single building of Rourke's. The four of them sat together in Mallory's shack after all the others had left. A wet cloth covered the unfinished statue. A door of the shack stood open to the first warmth of a spring night. A tree branch hung outside, with three new leaves against the black sky, stars trembling like drops of water on the edges of the leaves. There were no chairs in the shack. Mallory stood at the cast-iron stove, fixing hot dogs and coffee. Mike sat on the model stand, smoking a pipe. Rourke lay stretched out on the floor, propped up on his elbows. Dominique sat on a kitchen stool, a thin silk robe wrapped about her, her bare feet on the planks of the floor. They did not speak about their work. Mallory told outrageous stories, and Dominique laughed like a child. They talked about nothing in particular, sentences that had meaning only in the sound of the voices, in the warm gaiety, in the ease of complete relaxation. They were simply four people who liked being there together. The walls rising in the darkness beyond the open door gave sanction to their rest, gave them the right to lightness. The building on which they had all worked together, the building that was like a low, audible harmony to the sound of their voices. Rourke laughed, as Dominique had never seen him laugh anywhere else, his mouth loose and young. They stayed there late into the night. Mallory poured coffee into a mongrel assortment of cracked cups. The odor of coffee met the odor of the new leaves outside. In May, work was stopped on the construction of the Aquitania Hotel. Two of the owners had been cleaned out in the stock market. A third got his funds attached by a lawsuit over an inheritance disputed by someone. A fourth embezzled somebody else's shares. The corporation blew up in a tangle of court cases that were to require years of untangling. The building had to wait, unfinished. "I'll straighten it out if I have to murder a few of them," Kent Lansing told Rourke. "But I'll get it out of their hands. We'll finish it someday, you and I. But it will take time. Probably a long time. I won't tell you to be patient. Men like you and me would not survive beyond their first 15 years if they did not acquire the patience of a Chinese executioner and the hide of a battleship." Ellsworth Toohey laughed, sitting on the edge of Dominique's desk.
"The Unfinished Symphony. Thank God."
Dominique used that in her column. "The Unfinished Symphony on Central Park South," she wrote. She did not say, "Thank God." The nickname was repeated. Strangers noticed the odd sight of an expensive structure on an important street, left gaping with empty windows, half-covered walls, naked beams. When they asked what it was, people who had never heard of Rourke or of the story behind the building snickered and answered, "Oh, that's the Unfinished Symphony." Late at night, Rourke would stand across the street under the trees of the park and look at the black, dead shape among the glowing structures of the city's skyline. His hands would move as they had moved over the clay model. At that distance, a broken projection could be covered by the palm of his hand. But the instinctive, completing motion meant nothing but air. He forced himself sometimes to walk through the building. He walked on shivering planks hung over emptiness, through rooms without ceilings and rooms without floors, to the open edges where girders stuck out like bones through a broken skin. An old watchman lived in a cubbyhole at the back of the ground floor. He knew Rourke and let him wander around. Once he stopped Rourke on the way out and said suddenly, "I had a son once, almost. He was born dead." Something had made him say that, and he looked at Rourke, not quite certain of what he wanted to say. But Rourke smiled, his eyes closed, and his hand covered the old man's shoulder like a handshake. and then he walked away. It was only the first few weeks. Then he made himself forget the Aquitania. On an evening in October, Rourke and Dominique walked together through the completed temple. It was to be opened publicly in a week, the day after Stoddard's return. No one had seen it except those who had worked on its construction. It was a clear, quiet evening. The site of the temple lay empty and silent. The red of the sunset on the limestone walls was like the first light of morning. They stood looking at the temple, then stood inside, before the marble figure, saying nothing to each other. The shadows in the molded space around them seemed shaped by the same hand that had shaped the walls. The ebbing motion of light flowed in controlled discipline, like the sentences of a speech giving voice to the changing facets of the walls.
Rourke?
Yes, my dearest.
No. Nothing.
Chapter 12. The opening of the Stoddard Temple was announced for the afternoon of November 1st. The press agent had done a good job. People talked about the event, about Howard Rourke, about the architectural masterpiece which the city was to expect. On the morning of October 31st, Hopton Stoddard returned from his journey around the world. Ellsworth Toohey met him at the pier. On the morning of November 1st, Hopton Stoddard issued a brief statement announcing that there would be no opening. No explanation was given. On the morning of November 2nd, the New York Banner came out with the column One Small Voice by Ellsworth M. Toohey, subtitled Sacrilege. It read as follows. The time has come, the walrus said, to talk of many things, of ships and shoes, and Howard Rourke, and cabbages and kings, and why the sea is boiling hot, and whether Rourke has wings. It is not our function, paraphrasing a philosopher whom we do not like, to be a fly swatter, but when a fly acquires delusions of grandeur, the best of us must stoop to do a little job of extermination. There has been a great deal of talk lately about somebody named Howard Rourke. Since freedom of speech is our sacred heritage, and includes the freedom to waste one's time, there would have been no harm in such talk, beyond the fact that one could find so many endeavors more profitable than discussions of a man who seems to have nothing to his credit, except a building that was begun and could not be completed. There would have been no harm if the ludicrous had not become the tragic and the fraudulent. Howard Rourke, as most of you have not heard and are not likely to hear again, is an architect. A year ago he was entrusted with an assignment of extraordinary responsibility. He was commissioned to erect a great monument in the absence of the owner who believed in him, and gave him complete freedom of action. If the terminology of our criminal law could be applied to the realm of art, we would have to say that what Mr. Rourke delivered constitutes the equivalent of spiritual embezzlement. Mr. Hopton Stoddard, the noted philanthropist, had intended to present the city of New York with a temple of religion, a non-sectarian cathedral symbolizing the spirit of human faith. What Mr. Rourke has built for him might be a warehouse, though it does not seem practical. It might be a brothel, which is more likely, if we consider some of its sculptural ornamentation. It is certainly not a temple. It seems as if a deliberate malice had reversed in this building every conception proper to a religious structure. Instead of being austerely enclosed, this alleged temple is wide open, like a Western saloon. Instead of a mood of deferential sorrow, befitting a place where one contemplates eternity and realizes the insignificance of man, this building has a quality of loose, orgiastic elation. Instead of the soaring lines reaching for heaven, demanded by the very nature of a temple, as a symbol of man's quest for something higher than his little ego, this building is flauntingly horizontal, its belly in the mud, thus declaring its allegiance to the carnal, glorifying the gross pleasures of the flesh above those of the spirit. The statue of a nude female, in a place where men come to be uplifted, speaks for itself, and requires no further comment. A person entering a temple seeks release from himself. He wishes to humble his pride, to confess his unworthiness, to beg forgiveness. He finds fulfillment in a sense of abject humility. Man's proper posture in a house of God is on his knees. Nobody in his right mind would kneel within Mr. Rourke's temple. The place forbids it. The emotions it suggests are of a different nature. Arrogance, audacity, defiance, self-exaltation. It is not a house of God, but the cell of a megalomaniac. It is not a temple, but its perfect antithesis, an insolent mockery of all religion. We would call it pagan, but for the fact that the pagans were notoriously good architects. This column is not the supporter of any particular creed, but simple decency demands that we respect the religious convictions of our fellow men. We felt we must explain to the public the nature of this deliberate attack on religion. We cannot condone an outrageous sacrilege. If we seem to have forgotten our function as a critic of purely architectural values, we can say only that the occasion does not call for it. It is a mistake to glorify mediocrity by an effort at serious criticism. We seem to recall something or other that this Howard Roark has built before, and it had the same ineptitude, the same pedestrian quality of an overambitious amateur. All God's chillen may have wings, but unfortunately, this is not true of all God's geniuses. And that, my friends, is that. We are glad today's chore is over. We really do not enjoy writing obituaries. On November 3rd, Hopton Stoddard filed suit against Howard Roark for breach of contract and malpractice, asking damages. He asked a sum sufficient to have the temple altered by another architect. It had been easy to persuade Hopton Stoddard. He had returned from his journey crushed by the universal spectacle of religion, most particularly by the various forms in which the promise of hell confronted him all over the earth. He had been driven to the conclusion that his life qualified him for the worst possible hereafter under any system of faith. It had shaken what remained of his mind. The ship's stewards on his return trip had felt certain that the old gentleman was senile. On the afternoon of his return, Ellsworth Toohey took him to see the temple. Toohey said nothing. Hopton Stoddard stared, and Toohey heard Stoddard's false teeth clicking spasmodically. The place did not resemble anything Stoddard had seen anywhere in the world, nor anything he had expected. He did not know what to think. When he turned a glance of desperate appeal upon Toohey, Stoddard's eyes looked like jello. He waited. In that moment, Toohey could have convinced him of anything. Toohey spoke, and said what he said later in his column.
"But you told me this Roark was good,"
Stoddard moaned in panic.
"I had expected him to be good,"
Toohey answered coldly.
"But then why?"
"I don't know," said Toohey,
and his accusing glance gave Stoddard to understand that there was an ominous guilt behind it all, and that the guilt was Stoddard's. Toohey said nothing in the limousine on their way back to Stoddard's apartment, while Stoddard begged him to speak. He would not answer. The silence drove Stoddard to terror. In the apartment, Toohey led him to an armchair and stood before him, somber as a judge.
"Hopton, I know why it happened."
"Oh, why?"
"Can you think of any reason why I should have lied to you?"
"No, of course not. You're the greatest expert and the most honest man living, and I don't understand. I just simply don't understand at all."
"I do. When I recommended Roark, I had every reason to expect, to the best of my honest judgment, that he would give you a masterpiece. But he didn't. Hopton, do you know what power can upset all the calculations of men?"
What power?"
"God has chosen this way to reject your offering. He did not consider you worthy of presenting him with the shrine. I guess you can fool me, Hopton, and all men, but you can't fool God. He knows that your record is blacker than anything I suspected."
He went on speaking for a long time, calmly, severely, to a silent huddle of terror. At the end he said,
"It seems obvious, Hopton, that you cannot buy forgiveness by starting at the top. Only the pure in heart can erect a shrine. You must go through many humbler steps of expiation before you reach that stage. You must atone to your fellow men before you can atone to God. This building was not meant to be a temple, but an institution of human charity, such as a home for subnormal children."
Hopton Stoddard would not commit himself to that.
"Afterward, Ellsworth, afterward," he moaned. "Give me time."
He agreed to sue Roark, as Toohey suggested, for recovery of the costs of alterations, and later to decide what these alterations would be.
"Don't be shocked by anything I will say or write about this," Toohey told him in parting.
I shall be forced to state a few things which are not quite true. I must protect my own reputation from a disgrace which is your fault, not mine. Just remember that you have sworn never to reveal who advised you to hire Rourke." On the following day, sacrilege appeared in the banner and set the fuse. The announcement of Stoddard's suit lighted it. Nobody would have felt an urge to crusade about a building, but religion had been attacked. The press agent had prepared the ground too well. The spring of public attention was wound. A great many people could make use of it. The clamor of indignation that rose against Howard Rourke and his temple astonished everyone, except Ellsworth Toohey. Ministers damned the building in sermons, women's clubs passed resolutions of protest, a committee of mothers made page 8 of the newspapers with a petition that shrieked something about the protection of their children. A famous actress wrote an article on the essential unity of all the arts, explained that the Stoddard Temple had no sense of structural diction, and spoke of the time when she had played Mary Magdalene in a great biblical drama. A society woman wrote an article on the exotic shrines she had seen in her dangerous jungle travels, praised the touching faith of the savages, and reproached modern man for cynicism. The Stoddard Temple, she said, was a symptom of softness and decadence. The illustration showed her in breeches, one slim foot on the neck of a dead lion. A college professor wrote a letter to the editor about his spiritual experiences, and stated that he could not have experienced them in a place like the Stoddard Temple. Kiki Holcomb wrote a letter to the editor about her views on life and death. The AGA issued a dignified statement denouncing the Stoddard Temple as a spiritual and artistic fraud. Similar statements, with less dignity and more slang, were issued by the councils of American builders, writers, and artists. Nobody had ever heard of them, but they were councils, and this gave weight to their voice. One man would say to another, "Do you know that the Council of American Builders has said this temple is a piece of architectural tripe?" in a tone suggesting intimacy with the best of the art world. The other wouldn't want to reply that he had not heard of such a group, but would answer, "I expected them to say it, didn't you?" Hopton Stoddard received so many letters of sympathy that he began to feel quite happy. He had never been popular before. Ellsworth, he thought, was right. His brother men were forgiving him. Ellsworth was always right. The better newspapers dropped the story after a while, but the Banner kept it going. It had been a boon to the Banner. Gail Wynand was away sailing his yacht through the Indian Ocean, and Alva Skerritt was stuck for a crusade. This suited him. Ellsworth, too, he needed to make no suggestions. Skerritt rose to the occasion all by himself. He wrote about the decline of civilization and deplored the loss of the simple faith. He sponsored an essay contest for high school students on Why I Go to Church. He ran a series of illustrated articles on The Churches of Our Childhood. He ran photographs of religious sculpture through the ages, the Sphinx, gargoyles, totem poles, and gave great prominence to pictures of Dominique's statue, with proper captions of indignation, but omitting the model's name. He ran cartoons of Rourke as a barbarian with bear skin and club. He wrote many clever things about the Tower of Babel that could not reach heaven, and about Icarus who flopped on his wax wings. Ellsworth Toohey sat back and watched. He made two minor suggestions. He found in the Banner's morgue the photograph of Rourke at the opening of the Enright House, the photograph of a man's face in a moment of exultation, and he had it printed in the Banner over the caption, "Are you happy, Mr. Superman?" He made Stoddard open the temple to the public while awaiting the trial of his suit. The temple attracted crowds of people who left obscene drawings and inscriptions on the pedestal of Dominique's statue. There were a few who came and saw and admired the building in silence. But they were the kind who do not take part in public issues. Austin Heller wrote a furious article in defense of Rourke and of the temple, but he was not an authority on architecture or religion, and the article was drowned in the storm. Howard Rourke did nothing. He was asked for a statement, and he received a group of reporters in his office. He spoke without anger. He said, "I can't tell anyone anything about my building. If I prepared a hash of words to stuff into other people's brains, it would be an insult to them and to me. But I am glad you came here. I do have something to say. I want to ask every man who is interested in this to go and see the building, to look at it, and then to use the words of his own mind if he cares to speak." The Banner printed the interview as follows.
Mr. Rourke, who seems to be a publicity hound, received reporters with an air of swaggering insolence and stated that the public mind was hash. He did not choose to talk, but he seemed well aware of the advertising angles in the situation. All he cared about, he explained, was to have his buildings seen by as many people as possible. Rourke refused to hire an attorney to represent him at the coming trial. He said he would handle his own defense, and refused to explain how he intended to handle it, in spite of Austin Heller's angry protests. "Austin, there are some rules I'm perfectly willing to obey. I'm willing to wear the kind of clothes everybody wears, to eat the same food and use the same subways. But there are some things which I can't do their way, and this is one of them."
"What do you know about courtrooms and law? He's going to win."
"To win what?"
"His case."
"Is the case of any importance? There's nothing I can do to stop him from touching the building. He owns it. He can blast it off the face of the earth or make a glue factory out of it. He can do it whether I win that suit or lose it."
"But he'll take your money to do it with."
"Yes, he might take my money." Stephen Mallory made no comment on anything. But his face looked as it had looked on the night Rourke met him for the first time. "Steve, talk about it, if it will make it easier for you," Rourke said to him one evening.
"There's nothing to talk about," Mallory answered indifferently. "I told you I didn't think they'd let you survive."
"Rubbish. You have no right to be afraid for me."
"I'm not afraid for you. What would be the use?"
"It's something else." Days later, sitting on the windowsill in Rourke's room, looking out at the street, Mallory said suddenly,
"Howard, do you remember what I told you about the beast I'm afraid of?"
"I know nothing about Ellsworth Toohey. I'd never seen him before I shot at him. I'd only read what he writes. Howard, I shot at him because I think he knows everything about that beast."
Dominique came to Rourke's room on the evening when Stoddard announced his lawsuit. She said nothing. She put her bag down on a table and stood removing her gloves, slowly, as if she wished to prolong the intimacy of performing a routine gesture here in his room. She looked down at her fingers. Then she raised her head. Her face looked as if she knew his worst suffering, and it was hers, and she wished to bear it like this, coldly, asking no words of mitigation.
"You're wrong," he said.
They could always speak like this to each other, continuing a conversation they had not begun. His voice was gentle.
"I don't feel that."
"I don't want to know."
"I want you to know. What you're thinking is much worse than the truth. I don't believe it matters to me, that they're going to destroy it. Maybe it hurts so much that I don't even know I'm hurt. But I don't think so. If you want to carry it for my sake, don't carry more than I do. I'm not capable of suffering completely. I never have. It goes only down to a certain point, and then it stops. As long as there is that untouched point, it's not really pain. You mustn't look like that."
"Where does it stop?"
"Where I can think of nothing and feel nothing, except that I designed that temple. I built it. Nothing else can seem very important."
"You shouldn't have built it. You shouldn't have delivered it to the sort of thing they're doing."
"That doesn't matter. Not even that they'll destroy it. Only that it had existed."
She shook her head. "Do you see what I was saving you from when I took commissions away from you? To give them no right to do this to you. No right to live in a building of yours. No right to touch you. Not in any way."
When Dominique walked into Toohey's office, he smiled, an eager smile of welcome, unexpectedly sincere. He forgot to control it while his eyebrows moved into a frown of disappointment. The frown and the smile remained ludicrously together for a moment. He was disappointed, because it was not her usual dramatic entrance. He saw no anger, no mockery. She entered like a bookkeeper on a business errand. She asked, "What do you intend to accomplish by it?" He tried to recapture the exhilaration of their usual feud. He said,
"Sit down, my dear. I'm delighted to see you. Quite frankly and helplessly delighted. It really took you too long. I expected you here much sooner. I've had so many compliments on that little article of mine, but honestly, it was no fun at all. I wanted to hear what you'd say."
"What do you intend to accomplish by it?"
"Look, darling,
I do hope you didn't mind what I said about that uplifting statue of yours. I thought you'd understand I just couldn't pass up that one.
What is the purpose of that lawsuit?
Oh, well, you want to make me talk, and I did so want to hear you. But half a pleasure is better than none. I want to talk. I've waited for you so impatiently. But I do wish you'd sit down. I'll be more comfortable.
No.
Well, as you prefer, so long as you don't run away. The lawsuit? Well, isn't it obvious?
How is it going to stop him?
She asked, in the tone one would use to recite a list of statistics.
It will prove nothing, whether he wins or loses. The whole thing is just a spree for great numbers of louts, filthy but pointless. I did not think you wasted your time on stink bombs. All of it will be forgotten before next Christmas.
My God, but I must be a failure. I never thought of myself as such a poor teacher. That you should have learned so little in 2 years of close association with me, it's really discouraging. Since you are the most intelligent woman I know, the fault must be mine. Well, let's see, you did learn one thing, that I don't waste my time. Quite correct, I don't. Right, my dear. Everything will be forgotten by next Christmas, and that, you see, will be the achievement. You can fight a live issue. You can't fight a dead one. Dead issues, like all dead things, don't just vanish, but leave some decomposing matter behind. A most unpleasant thing to carry on your name. Mr. Hopton Stoddard will be thoroughly forgotten, the temple will be forgotten, the lawsuit will be forgotten, but here's what will remain. Howard Rourke? Why, how could you trust a man like that? He's an enemy of religion. He's completely immoral. First thing you know, he'll gyp you on your construction costs. Rourke, he's no good. Why, a client had to sue him because he made such a botch of a building. Rourke, Rourke, wait a moment. Isn't that the guy who got into all the papers over some sort of mess? Now, what was it? Some rotten kind of scandal. The owner of the building? I think the place was a disorderly house. Anyway, the owner had to sue him. You don't want to get involved with a notorious character like that. What for, when there are so many decent architects to choose from? Fight that, my dear. Tell me a way to fight it. Particularly when you have no weapons except your genius, which is not a weapon, but a great liability. Her eyes were disappointing. They listened patiently, an unmoving glance that would not become anger. She stood before his desk, straight, controlled, like a sentry in a storm who knows that he has to take it, and has to remain there even when he can take it no longer.
"I believe you want me to continue," said Tui.
"Now you see the peculiar effectiveness of a dead issue. You can't talk your way out of it. You can't explain. You can't defend yourself. Nobody wants to listen. It is difficult enough to acquire fame. It is impossible to change its nature once you've acquired it. No, you can never ruin an architect by proving that he's a bad architect. But you can ruin him because he's an atheist, or because somebody sued him, or because he slept with some woman, or because he pulls wings off bottle flies. You'll say it doesn't make sense. Of course it doesn't. That's why it works. Reason can be fought with reason. How are you going to fight the unreasonable? The trouble with you, my dear, and with most people, is that you don't have sufficient respect for the senseless. The senseless is the major factor in our lives. You have no chance if it is your enemy. But if you can make it become your ally...
Ah, my dear.
Look, Dominique, I will stop talking the moment you show a sign of being frightened.
Go on, she said.
I think you should now ask me a question. Or perhaps you don't like to be obvious and feel that I must guess the question myself. I think you're right. The question is, why did I choose Howard Rourke? Because, to quote my own article, it is not my function to be a fly swatter. I quote this now with a somewhat different meaning, but we'll let that pass. Also, this has helped me to get something I wanted from Hopton Stoddard, but that's only a minor side issue, an incidental, just pure gravy. Principally, however, the whole thing was an experiment, just a test skirmish, shall we say. The results are most gratifying. If you were not involved as you are, you'd be the one person who'd appreciate the spectacle. Really, you know, I've done very little when you consider the extent of what followed. Don't you find it interesting to see a huge, complicated piece of machinery, such as our society, all levers and belts and interlocking gears, the kind that looks as if one would need an army to operate it? And you find that by pressing your little finger against one spot, the one vital spot, the center of all its gravity. You can make the thing crumble into a worthless heap of scrap iron.
It can be done, my dear. But it takes a long time. It takes centuries. I have the advantage of many experts who came before me. I think I shall be the last and the successful one of the line, because, though not abler than they were, I see more clearly what we're after. However, that's abstraction. Speaking of concrete reality, don't you find anything amusing in my little experiment?
I do. For instance, do you notice that all the wrong people are on the wrong sides? Mr. Alvis Skerritt, the college professors, the newspaper editors, the respectable mothers, and the chambers of commerce should have come flying to the defense of Howard Rourke, if they value their own lives. But they didn't. They are upholding Hopton Stoddard. On the other hand, I heard that some screwy bunch of cafeteria radicals called the New League of Proletarian Art tried to enlist in support of Howard Rourke. They said he was a victim of capitalism, when they should have known that Hopton Stoddard is their champion. Rourke, by the way, had the good sense to decline. He understands. You do. I do. Not many others. Oh, well. Scrap iron has its uses.
She turned to leave the room.
Dominique, you're not going.
He sounded hurt.
You won't say anything. Not anything at all?
No.
Dominique, you're letting me down. And how I waited for you. I'm a very self-sufficient person as a rule, but I do need an audience once in a while. You're the only person with whom I can be myself. I suppose it's because you have such contempt for me that nothing I say can make any difference. You see, I know that, but I don't care. Also, the methods I use on other people would never work on you. Strangely enough, only my honesty will. Hell, what's the use of accomplishing a skillful piece of work if nobody knows that you've accomplished it? Had you been your old self, you'd tell me at this point that that is the psychology of a murderer who's committed the perfect crime and then confesses because he can't bear the idea that nobody knows it's a perfect crime. And I'd answer that you're right. I want an audience. That's the trouble with victims. They don't even know they're victims, which is as it should be. But it does become monotonous and takes half the fun away. You're such a rare treat. A victim who can appreciate the artistry of its own execution. For God's sake, Dominique, are you leaving when I'm practically begging you to remain?
She put her hand on the doorknob. He shrugged and settled back in his chair.
All right, he said. Incidentally, don't try to buy Hopton Stoddard out. He's eating out of my hand just now. He won't sell.
She had opened the door, but she stopped and pulled it shut again.
Oh, yes, of course, I know that you've tried. It's no use. You're not that rich. You haven't enough to buy that temple, and you couldn't raise enough. Also, Hopton won't accept any money from you to pay for the alterations. I know you've offered that, too. He wants it from Rourke. By the way, I don't think Rourke would like it if I let him know that you've tried.
He smiled in a manner that demanded a protest. Her face gave no answer. She turned to the door again.
Just one more question, Dominique. Mr. Stoddard's attorney wants to know whether he can call you as a witness. An expert on architecture. You will testify for the plaintiff, of course?
Yes. I will testify for the plaintiff.
The case of Hopton Stoddard versus Howard Rourke opened in February of 1931. The courtroom was so full that mass reactions could be expressed only by a slow motion running across the spread of heads, a sluggish wave, like the ripple under the tight-packed skin of a sea lion. The crowd, brown and streaked with subdued color, looked like a fruitcake of all the arts, with the cream of the AGA rich and heavy on top. They were distinguished men, and well-dressed, tight-lipped women. Each woman seemed to feel an exclusive proprietorship of the art practiced by her escort, a monopoly guarded by resentful glances at the others. Almost everybody knew almost everybody else. The room had the atmosphere of a convention, an opening night, and a family picnic. There was a feeling of our bunch, our boys, our show. Stephen Mallory, Austin Heller, Roger Enright, Kent Lansing, and Mike sat together in one corner. They tried not to look around them. Mike was worried about Stephen Mallory.
He kept close to Mallory, insisted on sitting next to him, and glanced at him whenever a particularly offensive bit of conversation reached them. Mallory noticed it at last and said,
"Don't worry, Mike. I won't scream. I won't shoot anyone."
"Watch your stomach, kid," said Mike. "Just watch your stomach. A man can't get sick just because he oughta."
"Mike, do you remember the night when we stayed so late that it was almost daylight, and Dominique's car was out of gas and there were no buses, and we all decided to walk home, and there was sun on the rooftops by the time the first one of us got to his house?"
"That's right. You think about that, and I'll think about the granite quarry."
"What granite quarry?"
"It's something made me very sick once, but then it turned out it made no difference at all in the long run."
Beyond the windows, the sky was white and flat, like frosted glass. The light seemed to come from the banks of snow on roofs and ledges, an unnatural light that made everything in the room look naked. The judge sat hunched on his high bench as if he were roosting. He had a small face, wizened into virtue. He kept his hands upright in front of his chest, the fingertips pressed together. Hopton Stoddard was not present. He was represented by his attorney, a handsome gentleman, tall and grave as an ambassador. Rourke sat alone at the defense table. The crowd had stared at him and given up angrily, finding no satisfaction. He did not look crushed, and he did not look defiant. He looked impersonal and calm. He was not like a public figure in a public place. He was like a man alone in his own room listening to the radio. He took no notes. There were no papers on the table before him, only a large brown envelope. The crowd would have forgiven anything, except a man who could remain normal under the vibrations of its enormous collective sneer. Some of them had come prepared to pity him. All of them hated him after the first few minutes. The plaintiff's attorney stated his case in a simple opening address. It was true, he admitted, that Hopton Stoddard had given Rourke full freedom to design and build the temple. The point was, however, that Mr. Stoddard had clearly specified and expected a temple. The building in question could not be considered a temple by any known standards, as the plaintiff proposed to prove with the help of the best authorities in the field. Rourke waived his privilege to make an opening statement to the jury. Ellsworth Monckton Toohey was the first witness called by the plaintiff. He sat on the edge of the witness chair and leaned back, resting on the end of his spine. He lifted one leg and placed it horizontally across the other. He looked amused, but managed to suggest that his amusement was a well-bred protection against looking bored. The attorney went through a long list of questions about Mr. Toohey's professional qualifications, including the number of copies sold of his book, Sermons in Stone. Then he read aloud Toohey's column, Sacrilege, and asked him to state whether he had written it. Toohey replied that he had. There followed a list of questions in erudite terms on the architectural merits of the temple. Toohey proved that it had none. There followed an historical review. Toohey, speaking easily and casually, gave a brief sketch of all known civilizations and of their outstanding religious monuments, from the Incas to the Phoenicians to the Easter Islanders, including, whenever possible, the dates when these monuments were begun and the dates when they were completed, the number of workers employed in the construction, and the approximate cost in modern American dollars. The audience listened, punch-drunk. Toohey proved that the Stoddard Temple contradicted every brick, stone, and precept of history.
"I have endeavored to show," he said in conclusion, "that the two essentials of the conception of a temple are a sense of awe and a sense of man's humility. We have noted the gigantic proportions of religious edifices, the soaring lines, the horrible grotesques of monster-like gods, or later, gargoyles. All of it tends to impress upon man his essential insignificance, to crush him by sheer magnitude, to imbue him with that sacred terror which leads to the meekness of virtue. The Stoddard Temple is a brazen denial of our entire past, an insolent no flung in the face of history. I may venture a guess as to the reason why this case has aroused such public interest. All of us have recognized, instinctively, that it involves a moral issue much beyond its legal aspects. This building is a monument to a profound hatred of humanity. It is one man's ego, defying the most sacred impulses of all mankind, of every man on the street, of every man in this courtroom,
This was not a witness in court, but Ellsworth Toohey addressing a meeting. And the reaction was inevitable. The audience burst into applause. The judge struck his gavel and made a threat to have the courtroom cleared. Order was restored, but not to the faces of the crowd. The faces remained lecherously self-righteous. It was pleasant to be singled out and brought into the case as an injured party. 3/4 of them had never seen the Stoddard Temple. "Thank you, Mr. Toohey," said the attorney, faintly suggesting a bow. Then he turned to Rourke and said with delicate courtesy, "Your witness." "No questions," said Rourke. Ellsworth Toohey raised one eyebrow and left the stand regretfully. "Mr. Peter Keating," called the attorney. Peter Keating's face looked attractive and fresh, as if he had had a good night's sleep. He mounted the witness stand with a collegiate sort of gusto, swinging his shoulders and arms unnecessarily. He took the oath and answered the first questions gaily. His pose in the witness chair was strange, his torso slumped to one side with swaggering ease, an elbow on the chair's arm. But his feet were planted awkwardly straight, and his knees were pressed tight together. He never looked at Rourke. "Will you please name some of the outstanding buildings which you have designed, Mr. Keating?" the attorney asked. Keating began a list of impressive names. The first few came fast, the rest slower and slower, as if he wished to be stopped. The last one died in the air, unfinished. "Aren't you forgetting the most important one, Mr. Keating?" the attorney asked. "Didn't you design the Cosmo Slotnick building?"
"Yes," whispered Keating.
"Now, Mr. Keating, you attended the Stanton Institute of Technology at the same period as Mr. Rourke?"
"Yes."
"What can you tell us about Mr. Rourke's record there?"
"He was expelled."
"He was expelled because he was unable to live up to the Institute's high standard of requirements?"
"Yes. Yes, that was it."
The judge glanced at Rourke. A lawyer would have objected to this testimony as irrelevant. Rourke made no objection. "At that time, did you think he showed any talent for the profession of architecture?"
"No."
"Will you please speak a little louder, Mr. Keating?"
"I didn't think he had any talent."
Queer things were happening to Keating's verbal punctuation. Some words came out crisply, as if he dropped an exclamation point after each. Others ran together as if he would not stop to let himself hear them. He did not look at the attorney. He kept his eyes on the audience. At times he looked like a boy out on a lark, a boy who has just drawn a mustache on the face of a beautiful girl on a Subway toothpaste ad. Then he looked as if he were begging the crowd for support, as if he were on trial before them. "At one time, you employed Mr. Rourke in your office?"
"Yes."
"And you found yourself forced to fire him?"
"Yes." "We did."
"For incompetence?"
"Yes."
"What can you tell us about Mr. Rourke's subsequent career?"
"Well, you know, career is a relative term. In volume of achievement, any draftsman in our office has done more than Mr. Rourke. We don't call one or two buildings a career. We put up that many every month or so."
"Will you give us your professional opinion of his work?"
"Well, I think it's immature, very startling, even quite interesting at times, but essentially adolescent."
"Then Mr. Rourke cannot be called a full-fledged architect?"
"Not in the sense in which we speak of Mr. Ralston Holcomb, Mr. Guy Francon, Mr. Gordon Prescott, no. But of course, I want to be fair, I think Mr. Rourke had definite potentialities, particularly in problems of pure engineering. He could have made something of himself. I've tried to talk to him about it. I've tried to help him. I honestly did, but it was like talking to one of his pet pieces of reinforced concrete. I knew that he'd come to something like this. I wasn't surprised when I heard that a client had had to sue him at last."
"What can you tell us about Mr. Rourke's attitude toward clients?"
"Well, that's the point. That's the whole point. He didn't care what the clients thought or wished, what anyone in the world thought or wished. He didn't even understand how other architects could care. He wouldn't even give you that, not even understanding. Not even enough to respect you a little, just the same. I don't see what's so wrong with trying to please people. I don't see what's wrong with wanting to be friendly and liked and popular.
Why is that a crime? Why should anyone sneer at you for that? Sneer all the time, day and night, not giving you a moment's peace, like the Chinese water torture. You know, where they drop water on your skull drop by drop?
People in the audience began to realize that Peter Keating was drunk. The attorney frowned. The testimony had been rehearsed, but it was getting off the rails.
Well, now, Mr. Keating, perhaps you'd better tell us about Mr. Rourke's views on architecture.
I'll tell you, if you want to know. He thinks you should take your shoes off and kneel when you speak of architecture. That's what he thinks.
Now, why should you? Why? It's a business like any other, isn't it? What's so damn sacred about it? Why do we have to be all keyed up? We're only human. We want to make a living. Why can't things be simple and easy? Why do we have to be some sort of goddamn heroes?
Now, Mr. Keating, I think we're straying slightly from the subject.
We're not. I know what I'm talking about. You do, too. They all do, every one of them here. I'm talking about the temple.
Don't you see? Why pick a fiend to build a temple? Only a very human sort of man should be chosen to do that, a man who understands.
And forgives, a man who forgives. That's what you go to church for, to be forgiven.
Yes, Mr. Keating. But speaking of Mr. Rourke,
well, what about Mr. Rourke? He's no architect. He's no good. Why should I be afraid to say that he's no good? Why are you all afraid of him?
Mr. Keating, if you're not well and wish to be dismissed...
Keating looked at him as if awakening. He tried to control himself.
After a while, he said, his voice flat, resigned.
No, I'm all right. I'll tell you anything you want. What is it you want me to say?
Will you tell us, in professional terms, your opinion of the structure known as the Stoddard Temple?
Yes, sure.
The Stoddard Temple.
The Stoddard Temple has an improperly articulated plan which leads to spatial confusion. There is no balance of masses. It lacks a sense of symmetry. Its proportions are inept.
He spoke in a monotone. His neck was stiff. He was making an effort not to let it drop forward.
It's out of scale. It contradicts the elementary principles of composition. The total effect is that of...
Louder, please, Mr. Keating.
The total effect is that of crudeness and architectural illiteracy. It shows no sense of structure, no instinct for beauty, no creative imagination.
No.
He closed his eyes.
Artistic integrity.
Thank you, Mr. Keating. That is all.
The attorney turned to Rourke and said nervously,
"Your witness."
"No questions," said Rourke.
This concluded the first day of the trial.
That evening, Mallory, Heller, Mike, Enright, and Lansing gathered in Rourke's room. They had not consulted one another, but they all came, prompted by the same feeling. They did not talk about the trial, but there was no strain and no conscious avoidance of the subject. Rourke sat on his drafting table and talked to them about the future of the plastics industry. Mallory laughed aloud suddenly, without apparent reason.
"What's the matter, Steve?" Rourke asked.
"I just thought...
Howard, we all came here to help you, to cheer you up. But it's you who are helping us instead. You're supporting your supporters, Howard."
That evening, Peter Keating lay half-stretched across a table in a speakeasy, one arm extended along the tabletop, his face on his arm. In the next 2 days, a succession of witnesses testified for the plaintiff. Every examination began with questions that brought out the professional achievements of the witness. The attorney gave them leads, like an expert press agent. Austin Heller remarked that architects must have fought for the privilege of being called to the witness stand, since it was the grand esprit of publicity in a usually silent profession. None of the witnesses looked at Rourke. He looked at them. He listened to the testimony. He said, "No questions," to each one. Ralston Holcomb on the stand, with a flowing tie and gold-headed cane, had the appearance of a grand duke or a beer garden composer. His testimony was long and scholarly, but it came down to,
"It's all nonsense. It's all a lot of childish nonsense. I can't say that I feel much sympathy for Mr. Hopton Stoddard. He should have known better.
It is a scientific fact that the architectural style of the Renaissance is the only one appropriate to our age. If our best people, like Mr. Stoddard, refuse to recognize this, what can you expect from all sorts of parvenus, would-be architects, and the rabble in general? It has been proved that Renaissance is the only permissible style for all churches, temples, and cathedrals. What about Sir Christopher Wren? Just laugh that off. And remember the greatest religious monument of all time, St. Peter's in Rome. Are you going to improve upon St. Peter's? And if Mr. Stoddard did not specifically insist on Renaissance, he got just exactly what he deserved. It serves him jolly well right.
Gordon L. Prescott wore a turtleneck sweater under a plaid coat, tweed trousers, and heavy golf shoes.
"The correlation of the transcendental to the purely spatial in the building under discussion is entirely screwy," he said. "If we take the horizontal as the one-dimensional, the vertical as the two-dimensional, the diagonal as the three-dimensional, and the interpenetration of spaces as the fourth-dimensional, architecture being a fourth-dimensional art, we can see quite simply that this building is homaloidal, or, in the language of the layman, flat. The flowing life which comes from the sense of order in chaos, or, if you prefer, from unity and diversity, as well as vice versa, which is the realization of the contradiction inherent in architecture, is here absolutely absent. I am really trying to express myself as clearly as I can, but it is impossible to present a dialectic state by covering it up with an old fig leaf of logic just for the sake of the mentally lazy layman.
John Eric Snight testified modestly and unobtrusively that he had employed Rourke in his office, that Rourke had been an unreliable, disloyal, and unscrupulous employee, and that Rourke had started his career by stealing a client from him. On the fourth day of the trial, the plaintiff's attorney called his last witness.
"Miss Dominique Francon," he announced solemnly.
Mallory gasped, but no one heard it. Mike's hand clamped down on his wrist and made him keep still. The attorney had reserved Dominique for his climax, partly because he expected a great deal from her, and partly because he was worried. She was the only unrehearsed witness. She had refused to be coached. She had never mentioned the Stoddard Temple in her column, but he had looked up her earlier writings on Rourke, and Ellsworth Toohey had advised him to call her. Dominique stood for a moment on the elevation of the witness stand, looking slowly over the crowd. Her beauty was startling, but too impersonal, as if it did not belong to her. It seemed present in the room as a separate entity. People thought of a vision that had not quite appeared, of a victim on a scaffold, of a person standing at night at the rail of an ocean liner.
"What is your name?"
"Dominique Francon."
"And your occupation, Miss Francon?"
"Newspaper woman."
"You are the author of the brilliant column Your House, appearing in the New York Banner."
"I am the author of Your House."
"Your father is Guy Francon, the eminent architect?"
"Yes." "My father was asked to come here to testify. He refused. He said he did not care for a building such as the Stoddard Temple, but he did not think that we were behaving like gentlemen."
"Well now, Miss Francon, shall we confine our answers to our questions? We are indeed fortunate to have you with us, since you are our only woman witness, and women have always had the purest sense of religious faith. Being, in addition, an outstanding authority on architecture, you are eminently qualified to give us what I shall call, with all deference, the feminine angle on this case. Will you tell us in your own words what you think of the Stoddard Temple?"
"I think that Mr. Stoddard has